Mahabharata, Chapter 77, Ashvatthama Punished. In the Kaurava camp, the Pandavas had risen before sunrise to say their prayers and perform their morning rites. As Yudhisthira completed his ablutions, Drishtadyumna's panicked chariot driver ran into his tent. After he had been calmed, he described the night's events. O king, Draupadi's sons, as well as those of Drupada, have all been slain. Ashvatthama, Kripa, and Kritavarma have committed a most cruel act. Even as our men slept, they were killed without mercy. Ashvatthama came like death himself and slashed at everyone with his sword. Anyone who tried to flee was cut down by the arrows of the other two. I think I am the only survivor. Somehow I managed to escape from the camp and have come here to tell you. Yudhisthira dropped to the ground and cried out. Upon hearing their brother's distress cry, the other Pandava brothers ran into him, and he informed them of what had happened. They too began to cry and fell to the earth. Yudhisthira's voice rose above the others. Alas! After defeating our enemies, we are now defeated. An already bitter victory, gained at the cost of the lives of so many kinsmen, has become still more bitter. What happiness can we now enjoy with all our sons, friends, and followers slain? Alas, they have died like merchants in a boat, who, having crossed the ocean, are wrecked in a shallow river. What will become of Draupadi? How will she live after hearing that her sons were so brutally slaughtered? Yudhisthira turned to Nakula and asked him to bring Draupadi to the Pandava camp, so that he could break the terrible news to her. After Nakula left, the other brothers comforted Yudhisthira, who then left the tent and mounted his chariot. Accompanied by his brothers and Satyaki, who had stayed with them in the Kaurava camp, he made his way to his own camp. As Yudhisthira entered the camp, he saw the ground littered by bodies. Severed heads and limbs lay strewn about, birds picking at them, and beasts tearing them apart. Seeing how the men had been slain without armor or weapons, the Pandavas seized their weapons and looked about wildly for signs of the killers. Upon not finding Ashvatthama or his party, they tearfully entered their son's tent and found the five headless corpses still lying on their beds. Horrified, they wailed in sorrow. Yudhisthira, feeling responsible for all the deaths, fell trembling to the ground. As Yudhisthira's brothers tried to comfort him, Nakula entered the tent with Draupadi. As soon as she saw her sons' bodies, she dropped senseless to the earth. Sprinkling her face with cool water, Bhima raised her and held on to her as she stood shaking uncontrollably. Her delicate face was darkened with grief, resembling the sun covered by storm clouds. Supported by Bhima, the Panchala princess said, "By good luck, O king, you have regained the earth after conquering your enemies. By good luck do your thoughts not dwell on Subhadra's son, that mighty-armed hero who was so cruelly killed by the Kauravas. Now it is my own sons who have been slain through sin. Seeing how they have been killed by Drona's vicious son even while they slept, I burn with unbearable grief. If that wretch does not pay for this crime, then I will die. I promise to observe the Praya vow and fast until death." Draupadi sat down and assumed a yogic posture, her legs folded by her side and her arms outstretched. "I will not move from this spot until you bring me the shining jewel from Ashvatthama's head, having slain him like a beast." Yudhisthira consoled the weeping princess. Draupadi looked up at Bhima and implored, "Mindful of a Kshatriya's duties, O Bhima, kill that wretch, like Indra kills Shambhara. There is no man in the world who can equal your prowess. Again and again you have been my refuge, and indeed the refuge of all your brothers. Remembering those deeds, kill Drona's son and be happy." Draupadi's voice was a wail, She covered her tear-streaked face with her hands. Her head fell to her breasts, and she wailed piteously. She could not get the sight of her five headless sons out of her mind. Repeatedly beating her chest, she filled the tent with her loud sobs. Bhima looked around at the carnage caused by Ashvatthama. His eyes blazed, and his huge chest rose and fell rapidly. He lifted his mace, still blood-stained from his battle with Duryodhan. Asking Nakula to become his charioteer, he ran out of the tent and leapt aboard his chariot. Within moments he was speeding out of the camp. He knew Ashvatthama would first have gone to see the dying Duryodhan, and would then head for Hastinapur. Nakula drove his chariot like the wind toward the road to Hastinapur. Soon after, Krishna arrived and discovered the grisly scene. After being informed that Bhima had set off in pursuit of Ashvatthama, he said, "O Yudhisthir, Bhima is dearer to you than life. Why do you stand here without acting? Surely you know that Drona gave Ashvatthama the Brahmashira, capable of consuming all three worlds. Although his father ordered him never to use that weapon against men, I am sure that in his desperation he will release it against Bhima. Only Arjuna, who also received the weapon from Drona, can check it. Do not delay. Order him to go after his brother. I will go with him." Krishna reminded Yudhisthira of an incident which had occurred many years ago in Dwarka, which indicated Ashvatthama's shameless and brazen nature. Knowing that there was no weapon more powerful than Krishna's Sudarshan Chakra disc, he had gone to Dwarka and asked Krishna to exchange it for the Brahmashira. Krishna had said, smiling, "The discus is here by my side, O hero. You may take it freely. I do not wish to have your weapon in exchange." But even after exerting all his strength, Ashvatthama could not move the discus. When he gave up, Krishna asked why he desired the discus. Ashvatthama replied, "If I had managed to take it, I would have challenged you to battle, O Yadu hero. After defeating you and holding your discus, I would then have been the most powerful man on earth." "You must stop him at once," Krishna concluded. "He is wrathful, wicked, and cruel. Let us leave immediately." Yudhisthira agreed. Krishna spoke consoling words to Draupadi, and after bowing to Yudhisthira, headed out of the tent. Preparing to follow him, Arjuna said to Draupadi, "O gentle lady, when I behead that Brahman, I will present you with his head. Then I will wipe the tears from your eyes and pacify you. After burning your son's bodies, you can then take your bath standing on his head." Arjuna spat out the words, "That Brahman." He knew it was forbidden to kill a Brahman. But by his behavior, Ashvatthama had shown himself to have fallen far from the path of Brahminical life. Krishna's charioteer, Daruka, still ready, stood just outside the tent. The chariot was yoked to his four horses, Shaibya, Sugriva, Megapushpa, and Balahaka. They stood still as Krishna and Arjuna climbed onto the chariot. Daruka gave the command, and the chariot moved off, quickly and smoothly picking up speed. The celestial standard, bearing the emblem of Garuda, decked with gold and gems, fluttered in the breeze as the chariot traveled rapidly toward Ashvatthama. Within a short time, they caught up with Bhima, who could not be deterred from pursuing Ashvatthama. Thinking only of the grieving Draupadi, he raced on with his mace held aloft. The two chariots sped toward the Ganges. When they reached its bank, they saw Ashvatthama amid the rishis. Drona's son had sought their shelter in hopes of being protected from the Pandavas. He knew there was nowhere in the world, indeed the three worlds, where he could hide from Krishna and Arjuna. He had thus entered among the Brahmins, knowing of the Pandavas' respect for them. He sat in their midst, clad only in a deerskin. Bhima leapt from his chariot and ran toward him with a roar. Ashvatthama looked up and saw the furious Pandava charging, as well as Arjuna and Krishna standing on their chariot nearby. Shiva's terrible power left him as soon as he had emerged from the Pandavas' camp, and he was terror-stricken when he saw the two mighty Pandavas and Krishna. He then thought of the Brahmashira. That irresistible weapon was his only hope. Taking up a reed of kusha grass, Ashvatthama recited the incantations to invoke the Brahmashira. Seeing this, Krishna shouted to Bhima to stop. The Pandava obediently halted in his tracks. As Ashvatthama invoked his weapon, a glaring light spread in all directions. Witnessing the blinding force of the most powerful of all the Brahma missiles, which even he had never seen before, Arjuna offered prayers to Krishna. My dear Lord Krishna, you are the almighty personality of Godhead. There is no limit to your different energies. Therefore, only you are capable of instilling fearlessness into the hearts of your devotees. Everyone in the flames of material miseries can find the path of liberation only in you. You are beyond the illusion of this world, and nothing is unknown to you. Therefore, kindly tell me, what is this blazing light which threatens to consume everything? Know from me that this is the all-powerful Brahmashira. This wicked man, afraid of imminent death, has thrown that weapon. But, O Partha, he has no knowledge of how to withdraw it. Krishna knew that Drona had not fully instructed his son on how to use the weapon, realizing that he would likely abuse its power. And now he had desperately released it, not caring that it could destroy the world even with himself in it. Krishna urged Arjuna to counter the weapon. Release your own Brahma missile, O Partha, which will combine with Ashvatthama's. Then you may withdraw both. Arjuna immediately touched Krishna's feet and thought of the mantras to invoke the weapon. He released the missile, and it met with Ashvatthama's in the sky. A great circle of blazing light filled the heavens. It appeared as if a second brilliant sun had risen and was about to burn the universe to ashes. Vyasadeva was sitting among the rishis on the bank of the river. Witnessing the combined power of the two Brahma weapons, he became alarmed. He ran over to Ashvatthama and said, O Brahman, what are you doing? Why have you thrown this weapon? It will destroy the world. Withdraw it at once. Ashvatthama looked at the rishi but made no reply. He was unable to withdraw the weapon, but he could redirect it to another target. Ashvatthama saw that his attempt to kill Arjuna and Krishna was being thwarted. His own powers were no match for Arjuna's superior military skills. Ashvatthama realized that death now stared him in the face. Surely the Pandavas would show him no mercy. Frustrated and filled with despair, he remembered that Uttara, Abhimanyu's wife, was pregnant with a child conceived before the prince's death. She was carrying the last of the Kuru line. Ashvatthama's mind raced. It was the proud Kurus who had killed his father and who were about to kill him too. Deciding that if he was to die, he would take the last hopes of the Kuru house with him. Ashvatthama concentrated on Uttara, and in particular on the child in her womb. He uttered mantras to redirect the Brahmashira, and it flew toward the Pandavas' camp, where Uttara had gone with Draupadi. Unaware of Ashvatthama's evil desire, Arjuna chanted the mantras to withdraw his own weapon, and the brilliant glare in the sky gradually subsided. Seeing that the danger had passed, Vyasadeva returned to his place amid the sages, who were in the midst of performing a sacrifice to Vishnu. In the Pandavas' camp, Uttara suddenly felt herself in danger. She was not sure of the cause, but could sense the approach of something. The beautiful princess, still only a young girl, fell to the ground. Her limbs trembled and she felt apprehensive. Terrified, she offered prayers to Krishna, whom she saw as her only shelter. Folding her palms and bowing her head, she said, O Lord of Lords, Lord of the universe, you are the greatest of mystics. Please protect me, for there is no one else who can save me from the clutches of death in this world of duality. hearing her heartfelt prayer, even as he sat on the chariot with Arjuna. Krishna, who understood Ashvatthama's intentions, at once expanded his personal energy to protect Uttara. He entered her womb in a mystical form and covered the child. As the Brahmashira approached, it was neutralized by Krishna and sent harmlessly into the sky. Uttara and the other Pandava ladies looked with wonder at the missile as it rose upwards like a blazing comet. Surely Krishna had saved them all from certain death. After withdrawing his celestial Brahma weapon, Arjuna fired another weapon at Ashvatthama, which immediately bound him with strong cords. Leaping from Krishna's chariot, he ran over to Ashvatthama and seized him by the hair, dragging him up onto the chariot. Although capable, Arjuna was reluctant to kill the son of his teacher. Seeing Arjuna sparing Ashvatthama's life, Krishna said, "O Partha, you should not show mercy to him. He is no Brahman. He has killed innocent boys in their sleep. This is always against religious codes. His sins have been great. You should kill him for his own good. Otherwise he will descend into hell. Furthermore, you have promised Draupadi that you will bring her the head of her son's killer. Do not hesitate. He has brutally murdered your family members and deserves death at your hands without doubt. Having blighted his own family name, he is but the burnt remains of his dynasty. Kill him at once." Throwing Ashvatthama to the floor, Arjuna replied, "I do not feel able to kill him, O Krishna. How could I perpetrate an act so painful to my own guru's heart? If it is your order, then it will be done. But for myself, I would rather take him to Yudhisthira to hear his judgment. Draupadi, too, may decide what should be done with this wretch." Krishna nodded. Dwarka urged on his horses, and in a short while they arrived at the camp, Bhima following just behind. Arjuna dragged Ashvatthama before Yudhisthira and Draupadi, saying, "Here is the killer of your sons. What should be done with him now?" The soft-hearted Draupadi felt compassion for Ashvatthama, who sat with his head down. As he was a Brahmin, she folded her palms in respect and said, "Release him, Arjuna, for he is the son of your martial teacher. It is said that the son is one with his father, and thus it is as if Drona himself were here. Indeed, Drona's wife did not ascend his funeral pyre because she had a son. Killing Ashvatthama will cause her, our worshipful superior, grief, and cannot be in accord with religious principles. My lord, do not make her cry like me. Nor should we, the kingly order, become guilty of the sin of needlessly slaying Brahmins. Such a sin can burn the whole body of a royal family to ashes." Yudhisthira, approving Draupadi's words, said, "Excellent, excellent. O gentle lady, your words are quite in accord with the sacred teachings of the Vedas." Arjuna and the twins expressed their agreement, but not Bhima. "We need show this man no mercy. He has mercilessly killed sleeping men for no purpose other than his own interests. Killing him is the only fitting punishment." Bhima advanced menacingly toward Ashvatthama with his fists clenched. His eyes were wide with fury, and he ground his teeth. Draupadi quickly came between him and Ashvatthama, who still said nothing and stared at the ground. Seeing the conflict, Krishna moved forward and placed a hand on Bhima's shoulder, telling him to be peaceful. Turning to Arjuna, he said, "A Brahmin, even when guilty of sin, is not to be killed. But if he is an aggressor, he must be killed. All these rulings are in the scriptures. You should act accordingly. You have to fulfill your promise to your wife, and you must also act to Bhimasen's satisfaction and mine. We both want you to kill this culprit." Arjuna looked at Krishna, who appeared to have four arms as he stood, holding Bhima at bay and comforting Draupadi. He could understand Krishna's equivocal instructions. Ashvatthama should both be killed and not killed. Taking out his razor-edged sword, he grabbed hold of Ashvatthama's topknot and severed the hair, along with the shining jewel that bound it. That jewel was the repository of Ashvatthama's mystic power, and as it was removed, he shriveled and collapsed. Presenting the jewel to Draupadi, Arjuna said, "Here is the gem you desired, O beautiful lady. Ashvatthama is now as good as dead, for to cut off the hair of a powerful warrior is equal to killing him. Indeed, the Vedas also prescribe such punishment for fallen Brahmins, but they never sanction killing the body." Bhima praised Arjuna for his intelligent act, which had satisfied everyone. He led Draupadi to a nearby couch and sat her down as Krishna spoke to Ashvatthama. "O son of Drona, all wise men will know you as a coward and a wretch from now on. You will have to endure the fruits of your sinful acts. For 3,000 years you will wander the earth, afflicted by disease and completely alone, unable to speak to anyone. Wretched and foul-smelling, you will dwell in deep forests and dreary wastelands. At the end of this period, purified at last of your sins, you will ascend to the higher regions. Go now, wicked man." Arjuna and Bhima dragged Ashvatthama to his feet and, unbinding him, drove him from the camp. Deprived of his jewel and cursed by Krishna, his power was gone, and he disappeared into the woods to begin his lonely exile. After his departure, Yudhisthira sorrowfully asked Krishna how Drona's sons had been able to kill the warriors in their camp. "I cannot see how it is possible that the sinful Ashvatthama could slay Drishtadyumna and so many other powerful fighters. Tell me, O Krishna, what power possessed him?" Krishna explained how Ashvatthama had worshipped Lord Shiva and obtained from him the power to kill the warriors. "But know from me that their time had come. Having carried out my will, they have now reached everlasting regions of bliss. Therefore, O King, you need not lament for them." Krishna consoled Yudhisthira with Vedic wisdom, while the other Pandavas and their women listened to his words. The sun was approaching the meridian, and Yudhisthira, feeling comforted, told his brothers that they should go to the Ganges to perform the last rites of their sons and other relatives. Wrapped in simple cotton cloths, the bodies of all the slain men were carried to the river bank, followed by the mournful procession of the Pandavas. The women walked at the head of the procession, followed by hundreds of Brahmins, who were reciting Vedic mantras and throwing kusha grass on the ground. Gradually they approached the river and began the funeral ceremonies. The many servants who had been brought from the city placed the thousands of corpses on large pyres built along the river bank. As the women's piteous wails carried into the breeze, the Brahmins performed the rituals, and the pyres were ignited. Everyone then entered the water and offered prayers for the departed souls. After the funerals were complete, the Pandavas and Krishna slowly began the journey to Hastinapur. In Hastinapur, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari sat alone in their chamber. After Krishna had left them, they were once again overcome by grief. The blind king sat with his head fallen to his chest, his breath coming in tearful sighs. He looked like a once great tree shorn of its branches. Sanjaya entered the chamber. As he announced himself, Dhritarashtra stood to greet him, but then collapsed. Sanjaya lifted the old king gently and said, "Why do you grieve, O monarch? Grief is useless. 18 Akshahinis have been killed and the earth divested of hundreds of kings. All your sons have been slain, along with so many of their kinsmen, friends, and counselors. You should now perform their funeral rites. What is the use of lying here, shedding tears?" Dhritarashtra cried out and dropped back onto the silk rug spread over the floor of his darkened chamber. Sanjaya pulled back the heavy drapes from the nearby window and sunshine poured into the room. The king and queen both appeared disheveled and withered by grief. Neither had slept for days. Sanjaya again helped Dhritarashtra to his feet, and the old king fell back onto his throne. In a choked voice he said, "Bereft as I am of sons, friends, and counselors, I will have to wander the earth in a wretched state. What is the use of living? Alas, I did not heed my adviser's words, and now I lament. Krishna told me to make peace with the Pandavas and rule the earth without a rival." Bhishma and Vidura agreed, "But I chose to follow my wicked son, and now he is dead, and I am experiencing an ocean of grief. Surely my sins in previous lives have been great, and thus I suffer now. Who on earth is more afflicted than me? Destiny has dealt me unbearable blows. I will end my life. Let the Pandavas come here and see me bent upon taking that final great journey toward the eternal Brahman." Sanjaya shook his head. He had heard Dhritarashtra's empty lamentation so many times. Taking hold of the king's hand, he replied, "Cast off your grief, O king. You are well acquainted with Vedic instructions regarding the certainty of death and the eternality of the soul. Everything happens as it should. All men receive the proper results of their own acts. For your fault, your sons have been destroyed. Only out of covetousness did you follow your son, who was ever guided by wicked men. Thus has your own perverted intelligence cut you, just like a sharp sword. So many people tried to redirect you to the path of virtue, but you would not listen. Although learned and intelligent, you were not qualified to be emperor of the earth, for you lacked discrimination." As he had done on previous occasions, Sanjaya made it clear to Dhritarashtra that he had only himself to blame. Now he was forced to repent. A man who keeps a burning coal in the folds of his cloth and then is burned by the fire is simply a fool if he laments. You and your son kept that pond of a fire in your midst and fanned it with your words and deeds. Now your sons have fallen into the blaze like insects. Why do you weep? Since Vidura had left the palace to go on pilgrimage, Sanjaya had more and more assumed the role of the king's adviser. As Vidura had always done, he spoke frankly and without fear. "Rise up, O monarch, and attend to your duties. Why do you cry for that which can no longer be avoided? All created beings will be destroyed. Everything high will eventually fall. Union always ends in separation, and life always ends in death. All creatures are like members of a caravan bound for the same country. Death will meet each of them in turn. None will escape. Thus it is immaterial who goes first. Your sons, meeting a glorious death in the thick of battle, have surely gone to higher places. The scriptures clearly state this. For a kshatriya, there is no death better than to die in battle. Your grief for your sons is unwarranted and meaningless. It will only increase if you indulge in it. Only the less intelligent allow themselves to be overcome by grief. It does not bestow any benefit upon the grief-stricken. Rather, it deviates him from his duty and thwarts his aims in life." Sanjaya had never stopped advising Dhritarashtra for his own good, despite the fact that his advice was ignored. Now that the king had lost everything, he would be far more likely to take good counsel seriously. Sanjaya spoke for some time, repeating the wisdom he had learned from the rishis. Dhritarashtra listened attentively, encouraging him to continue and feeling a sense of relief from his words. "O king, all men receive the results of their own actions. By acting with a desire for profit, one attains only repeated births in this world, along with their concomitant sufferings. Those who are wise act only to achieve liberation. By surrendering their acts unto the Supreme, they free themselves from the bondage of work. One who does his duty only as a sacrifice for the pleasure of Vishnu will surely rise to the regions of deathlessness where eternal happiness is enjoyed. Those whose hearts are possessed by lust and greed for material enjoyment, however, will continue to suffer. Dhritarashtra felt Sanjaya's reprimand. Repenting his foolishness, he rose from his throne and again fell to the floor. Gandhari wept silently as Sanjaya attended to him by sprinkling cool, perfumed water on his face. While the old charioteer consoled Dhritarashtra, Vyasadeva entered the chamber. He shone with spiritual effulgence, seeming to glide across the chamber as he approached the king. Hearing that the sage was present, Dhritarashtra got up to welcome him and said, "Alas, O Lord, I am undone. Fie on this world, and fie on humanity. The root of all of our pain is this state of human existence. How can one tolerate the pain of losing one's wealth and all one's loved ones? The calamity that has befallen me will only end with life itself. Therefore I shall end my miserable existence today." Dhritarashtra again fell sobbing to the ground. Seeing him in that state, Vyasadeva said, "O mighty monarch, hear my words. You are learned and you know everything. So take recourse in that wisdom now. When everything in this world is temporary, why do you grieve for that which is lost? Time itself, making your son the cause, has brought about this destruction. No one can change destiny. I have known destiny's course, settled by the celestials, and I will explain it to you now, so that you may find peace of mind." Vyasadeva explained how he had attended an assembly in Indra's court some time ago. There he had seen many great rishis, headed by Narada, and also the goddess Earth herself. The all-powerful Lord Vishnu had come to the assembly, where the earth had beseeched him. "My dear Lord, you have promised to relieve my burden. Let that come to pass soon." Lord Vishnu had replied, "The eldest of Dhritarashtra's 100 sons will accomplish your desire. Through that king, your object will be achieved. Fighting for his cause, all the kings who are exploiting your resources will meet in a fierce battle and slay one another. O beautiful damsel, return and continue to bear the weight of all your creatures. Your burden will soon be lightened by the battle." Vyasadeva went on to explain that Duryodhan was an incarnation of Kali, the presiding deity over the impending age of quarrel and suffering. It was by his dark influence that the slaughter had been brought about. Dhritarashtra should not blame the Pandavas. They too had been told by Narada of the arrangement made by the celestials. Filled with grief to hear that they would be involved in such a carnage, they had endeavored to avoid it. But Duryodhan would not be swayed. Vyasadeva continued, "I have thus revealed to you the god's secret, O king. You should not grieve. All the warriors who died are now living in the higher planets in joy. The earth is no longer feeling the burden of them, and a righteous monarch has assumed rulership in the form of Yudhisthira. Thus the world will now be led on the path of virtue. Cast off your sorrow. If the compassionate Yudhisthira sees you in this state, he will give up his life. Take hold of yourself. Spend your remaining days in asceticism and attain the goal of life." Dhritarashtra sighed. Getting to his feet with Sanjaya's assistance, he replied, "O best of the rishis, thinking of my sons, I am sunk in grief and almost losing consciousness, but your words have convinced me to continue living. Understanding that everything has been ordained by the gods, I will endeavor to put aside my sorrow. Thus will I live." Vyasadeva then disappeared. Feeling comforted, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari returned to their private quarters to rest, having spent the night grieving.